It can be a little hard to keep up in the world today. With modern electronics and the internet, we can stay connected to each other pretty much anytime, anywhere, and there's always so much to take in. And as a few people have pointed out, that's not necessarily a good thing. Our guest goes a bit further in this hour. Matt Haig has been thinking deeply about life on Earth today. He shares the thoughts with us in a book called Notes on a Nervous Planet. Matt Haig has several books out there for your perusal and pleasure. His memoir on depression, Reasons to Stay Alive, is an international bestseller. He's also written children's books and novels, including How to Stop Time. Matt Haig, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
So where our previous book we talked about, Reasons to Stay Alive, was about depression, this is less about depression than anxiety. And it starts with you in an internet debate. Who were you debating with?
Well, the funny thing is I can't even remember who I was debating with, but I used to get into a lot of pointless arguments, like lots of people did, a lot of pointless political arguments on the internet, on Twitter specifically. And I could waste whole days or even weekends doing that. And I was starting to realize, as someone who's had occasional mental health problems over the last 20 years, I was starting to realize it was impacting my mental health. And these were people I would never meet in real life. I would have never met them in the days before social media, and yet their opinions were affecting me in ways they shouldn't have been affecting me. And it was a bit of a wake-up call.
As you put it, somebody 8,000 miles away had you twisted up in knots.
Exactly. And this was on more than one occasion. You know, that was a specific example at the start of the book. But, yeah, I mean, I used to be quite addicted to Facebook. Then it became Twitter, and then I got really into Twitter. And Twitter, as you know, there's a lot of negative stuff on there and a lot of sort of hostile behavior. And, being kind of a sensitive-minded kind of person, I used to get too wrapped up in all that stuff.
So how did you work to lessen the feeling? It certainly helps that you're married, and your wife, Andrea, sounds like she's very patient and understanding and drops a few hints that maybe this is not the behavior you should be displaying right now.
Well, it took me a long time, actually, to realize. I mean, I first had experience of depression and anxiety and panic attacks and things like that nearly two decades ago, so way before social media. So I'm definitely not pinning all my problems on my use of social media or Twitter or Instagram or anything like that. But what I've started to realize in recent times is that there are a lot of aspects of modern life, of which social media is one, that are impacting our mental health in negative ways. And we're at a point now where technology is changing so fast. You know, in the last 10 years, almost every aspect of our life has been changed in some way due to technology. How we work, how we fall in love, how we communicate with each other, how we live generally is impacted via the things in our pockets, the smartphones we carry around with us. And for me, as well as arguing with strangers on the internet, which I try not to do anymore, the other thing is just the sheer amount of time I was spending online. So I'd be spending hours upon hours online. And writing this book itself was a kind of therapy, because it was my sort of wake-up call to myself of what I was doing and the research that's out there about how it is having a psychological impact. And that alone made me more disciplined about how much I should be on it, how I should use it when I am on it, what I should get out of it. Because obviously the internet is a brilliant thing. Social media can be a brilliant thing, you know, in terms of the people we can connect with, what we want to do. But it's so easy to go online and use it in a way that isn't very mindful or aware, and to get distracted quite easily. And obviously there's a lot of companies out there, a lot of Silicon Valley big business interests out there, which their whole business model is based around distracting us, is on our distraction. And so it can be quite hard to sort of untangle yourself from the spider's web, but I'm getting better at it.
You say in the book that you're not saying that everything is a disaster and we're all screwed, because we already have Twitter for that. So how do you want people to view this book from the outset? As they're picking it up, what should they be thinking about?
Right. Well, definitely, this is not a book for someone who wants every single answer about social media, modern life, and mental health. This is a book that's asking questions mainly. It's asking questions which I don't think are being asked that much in terms of how we're living and how that's affecting us and how much has changed. You know, we talk all the time about progress and technological progress and evolution, but the fundamental fact is human beings haven't evolved biologically or in terms of our brain chemistry for at least 10,000 years. You know, there hasn't been any fundamental evolution shift in us. And yet we're in this world in the 21st century where it's so far removed from what we've been evolved for. You know, there's something called Dunbar's number, which is 150, which is the number of people we're expected to have some kind of meaningful relationship with our lives. You know, that is why if you go back 1,000 years in Europe, all the villages were roughly having populations of 150 people. That's a sort of natural, organic community of people. And yet now the numbers are so much greater, you know, in terms of our social networks and everything else. You can encounter 150 new people before you get out of bed in the morning. So it's that sort of thing that I you know, it's not just social media, but a lot of it is technological. Even something like sleep is being impacted by technology. We are being pushed further and further and further away from our natural rhythms, our natural way of living, our natural sense of community. And technology is at the root of a lot of that.
We'll come back to sleep later in the conversation. There does get a chapter in the book on that. The book is called Notes on a Nervous Planet. Matt Haig is the author and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. And we'll be back in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about how we function as human beings in the modern world, the world that has apparently picked up speed considerably in the last few years as we get constant reminders from the internet and social media and all the other electronics around us and what we do with those. Matt Haig recommends getting yourself a little apart time. His book is called Notes on a Nervous Planet. He has scored blurbs from both Nigella Lawson and Stephen Fry, among others, for the book. He has been writing for a long time now, including a memoir on depression called Reasons to Stay Alive. You can join the conversation as we talk about the anxieties that we get from the world we live in today and how to let those abate just a bit. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. It was interesting when you were talking about the fact that we have not changed in an evolutionary sense from what existed before we basically had civilization. But when we talk about the kinds of changes that are going on in the world today, how different are our concerns about, you know, from, say, the concerns of people who thought that trains going faster than 30 miles an hour in the 1840s would drive us insane?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. And often when you start criticizing anything to do with social media, people will immediately say, well, people used to say the same about cinema, or people used to say the same about newspapers or the printed press and all of that. And there's a valid point to be made there, to which I'd say a few things. I mean, firstly, just because something has been around for 100 years or 200 years even, doesn't always mean that it's 100% wholly good for us. You know, this fast-paced world we live in. I mean, one thing I talk about in Notes on a Nervous Planet is not a new invention at all. It's the electric light bulb, which is, you know, something that none of us would really want to go without in terms of our modern life. But what's quite interesting is Thomas Edison, who famously patented the first light bulb, he was in a not only an evangelist of electricity, but he was also very against the idea of people having 8 hours sleep a night. So he believed the electric light bulb, for instance, would usher in this new age where no one had to go to sleep hardly at all.
I never made that connection. He was a famous cat napper. Of course he would not mind having electric lights on all the time.
Yeah, and, you know, 4 hours of sleep a night, and he saw it as the age of the 24-hour society and 24-hour factories, which, of course, he did usher in. Now, some people say that as soon as electric light bulbs arrived, people started to have longer evenings at home for obvious reasons before going to bed, and that sleep was starting to be affected. So I'd say two things. I'd say that, you know, sometimes, yes, obviously, possibly not in the case of trains, but some aspects of older technologies have had negative impacts on the environment and on our minds. But it's just for such a long time that's become a sort of thing we've got used to. But also, I honestly think in the specific case of social media, it will be seen as less like another thing like newspapers and television, and more as a health issue. So the equivalent of social media companies would therefore be tobacco companies or fast food companies, which now need to regulate and moderate themselves because so much information has come out and there's been so much public pressure. I think the reason we're not quite there yet is because we don't quite understand mental health in the same way we do physical health. You know, sometimes we even see stress as quite a good thing or something that, you know, is character building. So we're not quite at the point at which we can say, oh, actually, this is really dangerous for us and these companies need to do something about it. But I do think we're getting there. And also, another thing I would just add, it's not the typical Luddites, the people who are traditionally anti-progress, who are being the negative voices in this. Actually, the strongest and most compelling voices against, about the mental health impact of social media is actually coming from the technology companies themselves and the people who used to work at the technology companies, who are themselves saying, I don't think teenagers should be on social media. That was Tim Cook, who did a talk in a British school. Tim Cook, obviously the CEO of Apple, said that he doesn't believe teenagers should be on social media because it's so addictive. We've got the guy who invented the Facebook like button, now wishing he hadn't invented the like button on Facebook because it became so addictive and he didn't quite realize what he was inventing. We've got tons of technology workers who send their kids to schools with no technology, all kinds of things going on. So I do think it's not necessarily a totally bad thing, but given the amount of change, given how many areas of our life it's affecting, I do think we need to take a good step back and have a real proper look and think about what it's doing to us.
Matt Haig is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is called Notes on a Nervous Planet. You do nail my business in the section on anxiety and news. I mean, you know, I have to reluctantly admit that, of course, you know, fear does work. It gets people to pay attention to the news. And I found this more in working in commercial television news than I do in public radio. But still, you know, the things that get your attention are like, oh, my God, what happened?
Yeah. No, absolutely. And, of course, now we have 24-hour news and we have Twitter timelines full of breaking news, and often in a quite confusing way because it's playing out in real time. And so people aren't getting the information, so therefore the fear increases. And we're quite addicted, and it's a natural thing. You know, that's human nature. We want to find out where the problems are and where the fear is. But, you know, once upon a time, the fear would have been in a four-mile radius from our home. Now, of course, we can find out things, terrible things happening anywhere in the world. So we're processing a lot of information, probably too much information, and not all of it we can do anything about. So obviously people can vote for the politicians they like, they can do change in the local community, they can watch their carbon footprint and stuff like that. But a lot of the stuff we're watching and witnessing, we don't feel like we've got direct involvement in. So it's just anxiety that's given to us that we can't really do anything with. You know, if you're faced with the bear, you can run away from the bear, but you can't run away from the world or from news other than switch it off sometimes.
And it's interesting we're having this conversation because we talked to a researcher last week who was giving advice for how teachers can help kids deal with disasters they see in the media that they can do nothing about. It scares them. They can be thousands of miles away, but they can't do much. So we run around sometimes with our hair on fire. Do you have any advice, Matt, though, for how people can stay informed and yet not fearful?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to get out of this idea that we need to be constantly knowing every 5 minutes what's going on in the world, what the president has tweeted, this, that, and the other. You know, up until right up until the end of the 20th century, and even into this century, a lot of people got their news twice a day. They had their sort of morning newspaper, they'd have an evening news roundup. So I think getting over this idea that we, for change to happen or progress to happen or to be informed, you need to be up to speed every 5 seconds. You know, it's fundamentally wrong, and it's not how human society has worked. So I don't think we should have any guilt or shame in occasionally stepping back from the news a little bit and just processing things, because it's all right getting these information bulletins all the time, but, you know, occasionally you need to step back to get the context and get perspective and to think about things. So it's not about totally turning your back on the world or turning your back on society. It's just how we process things. You know, do we need to be continually plugged in? And I don't think we do.
I have noticed that if you check the Washington Post 3 times an hour, the same stories are generally going to be on top all 3 times. This is one of the points that Matt Haig gets around to in his book, Notes on a Nervous Planet. You can join the conversation on The Exchange as we talk about the rate of change and the level of anxiety in the world today and what we do about that. 800-838-3760 by phone. You can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. And you can open my eyes with this list of things that we have gotten since the year 2000. When there were no selfies, no YouTube, and on and on and on. Things really have changed fast.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And whether we think that change is wholly bad or wholly good is kind of irrelevant, because one thing we can't deny is that it has fundamentally happened and the rate of change is increasing. Now, on a personal level, in your personal life, if you go through a massive period of change, even if it's a good change, it can be psychologically unsettling and often, even in some cases, trigger depression or anxiety. So someone could win the state lottery, or they could have the baby they always wanted, or they could get married, or something that's outwardly the most positive thing. But because it's such a change, it can be unsettling. Moving house is another example. Now what's happening, of course, is that level of change is happening everywhere and all at once, and we're all connected. So we're not only experiencing it on an individual level, but collectively, and we're all influencing each other's psychology. So it's easy to get into states of sort of mass hysteria, mass panic, as you occasionally see if you spend too much time on Twitter.
Which makes sense when you think about the things that we wouldn't have known about, for example, until we got like a friend's Christmas letter years ago. Now we know right away because of Facebook and that sort of stuff. And it brings me back to a comment that you write earlier in the book about our mental states are, to a degree, products of social states. Can you flesh that out for us?
Yeah, and this is actually it might seem like a kind of depressing idea for some people, but for me it's a comforting one. Basically, our minds, we have brain chemistry that's to do with our DNA, and it's to do with our biology, and we're sort of born with it. But our brains and minds aren't these static things that are set in stone. There's something that neuroscientists call neuroplasticity, which is how your mind evolves and literally changes shape and changes structure in terms of the things you do and how you behave and the things you watch and witness and experience in life. And so the idea of whether things are nature or whether things are nurture is kind of a outdated idea, because actually it's both all at once. It is our nature reacting to the world. So our minds are shaped massively by the societies they're in, and this affects rates of mental illness. And there's all kinds of ways that we've worked this out. For instance, the state of Fiji, the country of Fiji, didn't have television until the 1990s, when it had its own national broadcast state-funded channel. And when it started having television, the shows it played were essentially American shows, the popular shows of the day, the TV shows like Melrose Place, Beverly Hills 90210. And so they're getting these very sort of Western ideals. And up until that point in Fiji, there had been no cases whatsoever of eating disorders recorded anywhere in Fiji, or even the equivalent of them. And in fact, it had been a compliment to tell a woman in Fiji that they were big and that they put on weight, and that was a sign of health and all of that. And so suddenly, at the end of the 90s, at the same time that they'd got these new TV shows, rates of anorexia and bulimia and eating disorders in general suddenly spiked from out of nowhere. And, you know, the only sort of common overlapping factor was suddenly everyone was watching television, and suddenly everyone was faced with these new ideals of what beauty was. And so that's one way. And increasingly in the West, where we've been surrounded by such imagery for a long time, we haven't been surrounded by it to the level that young people are now subjected to it on things like Instagram, with these special apps where you can make yourself better looking. And not this isn't just about women and girls either. It's men and boys too. You know, there's these apps which make you look like you've got a six-pack and you've got this gym body sort of workout and stuff like that, which, you know, can be fun and games if you're of a certain mindset. But for a lot of people who are sensitive and a bit anxious about their appearance and have social anxiety, those things can be massive, and it can exacerbate how people feel. So I think that's an example of how cultural things can shape mental states.
Matt Haig is our guest on The Exchange. His book is Notes on a Nervous Planet. And here's a call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff. When trains started going over 40 miles an hour, we did lose our minds. We now both have Donald Trump and Brexit at the same time.
Darn that high-speed rail in Britain.
Doggone it. It's just insane. Seriously, two things to contribute here. One, I shot my television in 1996, and I have had far greater peace of mind than I think I would have otherwise. And a great deal of that was that I had my expectations brought back to the reality of being a guy in southwestern Oregon, as opposed to a multi-billionaire in New York City. That's one aspect to it. The other aspect is that I'm convinced that the communications that we have now are desensitizing us as human beings. And I'll just leave those comments, and you guys take them where you want to.
All right. Thanks, Paul. Good to hear from you. Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I think it's a case that when we don't have to necessarily shoot our television sets, but when we sort of switch off and disconnect, it can be a fundamental change. I recently had a month without social media. I had a complete blanket ban on everything. And I was still using the internet, but I was using it in different ways. So I was using it to find information I wanted to find out, to listen to new music that I hadn't heard before, watch YouTube videos I was interested in, old film footage. It's all great stuff out there. So it's not about necessarily banning yourself completely, but being a little bit more in tune with what you really want to get out of it.
All right. So I want to come to a point on how we deal with devices through history, because I nearly laughed out loud about your account about Samuel Pepys and his pocket watch.
Yeah. Well, basically, Samuel Pepys, the famous London diarist from the 1600s, he was quite a rich guy for the time. So he had every sort of status symbol you could have going for him. He was sort of friends with the king. He was in high society. He'd been the head of the merchant navy, and he wrote his amazing diary. Anyway, I think the year was 1665. He bought himself the status symbol of the day, which was a pocket watch. It was the latest pocket watch, and it wasn't even a very good pocket watch, because they hadn't got the spring mechanism yet to make it supremely accurate. So it's probably out by about 20 minutes. But anyway, he wrote in his diary that he was compulsively checking it to see what time it was, to see if it was near 1 o'clock every 5 seconds. So basically, it was like a smartphone. And he ended up having to get rid of a pocket watch because he remembered how calm his mind had been before. And, you know, we forget that even time devices themselves, like clocks and watches, even those, in the big human scare of things, even that's quite modern technology. Because if you go back to, like, sundials at least needed the sun to be up in the sky to work. So at least you still have the rhythm of night and day. And now, of course, we're so compartmentalized. You know, we always get up because it's 7 o'clock rather than because it's the time we feel is right to get up. You know, there's no cave painting anywhere in the world, I don't think, of a caveman waking up because they're late for a human resource meeting.
Right, nobody,
you know,
dashing.
We're in a very different world.
Yeah, nobody dashing with a briefcase in a cave painting.
No one dashing, exactly. Yeah,
right,
no rush hour.
Well, what do you know? So the more we measure time, the less we have of it. No big surprise there. We're learning a lot with Matt Haig. His book is called Notes on a Nervous Planet. We'll come back and talk more with Matt and take some more contact from you by phone and email when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're proud to have Matt Haig as our guest today. He's written many books that have sold very well, including a memoir on depression called Reasons to Stay Alive. He's followed that up with a book about anxiety in the modern world, his certainly as a starting point, but the anxiety of lots of other people as well. The book is called Notes on a Nervous Planet. It's about appreciating what's around us, sometimes without the electronic devices and the constant contact. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Matt, there's a chapter in here on life overload where you point out all the many things that are now at our fingertips. Why is that not great?
Well, yeah, I mean, choice is a good thing, and we have a lot more choice than ever. We have more choice over everything. We have amazing TV shows we can watch at any one time, more books than ever before. The problem comes when the fact that actually with choice there are diminishing returns. So there's a threshold. When we have so much choice that we don't know what to do with it, it becomes paralyzing. And actually there was a major brand, I think it was Unilever, who tried this out with shampoos. They were trying to work out how to sell more shampoo. And so they went to the supermarket, and they had a stack full of, I think it was 17 different brands of shampoo. And on the next aisle, they just had 3 different brands of shampoo. And what happened was they sold far more shampoo when people were presented with just 3 varieties of shampoo than when they were presented with 17. So what that tells us is that we become a little bit paralyzed and a bit confused when there is so much choice, and almost a pointless choice. You know, we don't really need more than 3 types of shampoo. And, you know, we're surrounded everywhere with so many different brands, so many different options of everything, that it's become a bit too much. We've passed the point at which it's useful to us. So we often get fear of missing out on things, you know, but feel like we're being left behind, feeling like we've got no time, because we're so distracted and so overworked that there isn't that space to really have that freedom that we think choice offers us.
Let's take a phone call here from Tim in Grants Pass, who I think wants to bring the conversation back to our discussion of constant connection. Tim, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Matt Haig.
Yes. I'm about 78 years old now. Anxiety is, well, it's caused me to have a real bad short-term memory. I live alone, which is my problem. I contacted some numbers that I wanted to know if there are people that would like a place to meet or I could join them, whatever. And they kept asking me, well, do I have a case number? Am I part of some government-related already trying to help me thing? And I got nowhere. It was very frustrating, and I realized because I had just been out of the loop, out of whatever for so long, they kept wanting to know if I wanted Meals on Wheels. I said, no, what I would like was Wheels to Meals, where a van would come around and pick up several of us, and we'd help set up the place and meet other people and serve the thing and whatever and clean up afterwards. Those Meals on Wheels would just isolate me more.
Mm-hmm. So do you use social media? Is that do you stay connected that way?
Well, I don't know what you're saying.
All right, there's just a question about other places to make connection. But I see your point is that that you know there is anxiety and isolation as well as in being connected too much to too many people. Thanks for that, Jim. Good to hear from you. Any thoughts from you, Matt?
Yeah, no, I liked this point about Meals Two Wheels rather than Meals on Wheels, because we're facing, and it's not just the older generation, younger generation too, we're at a point now where despite our connected age, rates of loneliness are sky high. You know, this is what, the loneliest era there has ever been, and yet, paradoxically, it's also the most connected era there has ever been. So we're losing something in terms of community, which is really, really sad. And of course, social media, the attraction of social media is that if you're feeling lonely, you'll go on and you'll connect with people. But it's not quite giving our brains the connection they need or that they evolved to experience. So we always feel at the end of it a little bit unfulfilled. And you can only really get that from real-life communication, going outside, meeting people, talking to people, that old-fashioned thing called face-to-face contact.
It really does make a difference. Jim, thanks for calling, and I hope you get some of that fairly soon. There's a chapter in, there's a section in here that just brightened. A lot of this, you know, really makes you think a little harder about things that people have said in the past in the context of our present. Like Leo Tolstoy celebrating all the flood of books in his time and all the information the world was sharing, but he thought it was going to mean that we couldn't lie to each other anymore. Kind of got that backwards, didn't he?
Yeah, that is true. Yes, I know. And even more recently, people have thought, you know, even Tim Berners-Lee, when he invented the internet, he saw it as a freeing up of information, and that, you know, the world's library would be there and all knowledge would be opened up. And that's not quite the way it's been, that utopian vision, because, of course, what people didn't realize is that there would be all the information in the world, but it would also be lost amid so much misinformation and confusion, going back to my last point about confusion. So we're in the age of information at the same time as we're in the age of misinformation, and they're existing simultaneously.
Yeah, you get all the bad out there with the good at the same time. There's an interlude in the chapter about internet anxieties in which your wife, Andrea, is worried about you online. And I wonder, Matt, if you had concerns about the research for this book being an excuse for spending more time than usual online.
That is a very good question, actually. And, well, I did definitely spend a lot of time online researching this, but I don't find that as unhealthy. If you're researching a book, you know, it's the literal equivalent of going to the library. So at least my time online with this was focused, because I'm not saying, I'm definitely not wagging my finger and saying, don't spend time online. You know, that's ridiculous. We can't put the genie back in the bottle. It's just about being aware of what we're doing. And so I actually had fun writing this book, because it was a way of, you know, me trying to work out for myself primarily, but hopefully to help other people too, you know, what are we doing that's good for us? What are we doing that's bad for us? And putting mental health on the same sort of level as physical health, because with physical health, we talk all the time about stuff that's good for us and bad for us. It might be a pre-existing condition. It might be our DNA. But with pretty much any physical health condition, we're aware that there are things we do that can make us feel better and things we do that make it worse. And we're not quite there yet with the mental health in terms of what makes us better and worse. You know, we're not quite there. You know, physical health has the diet, exercise, all the rest of it. With mental health, it's a bit more ambiguous. So I was trying to work through that and research that. And that was quite enlightening for me.
We get into a section of the book where we talk about the kinds of things that go viral in today's world. And you put out a tweet at one point that said, anxiety is my superpower. And what did that produce?
I produced a lot of anxiety, because I was getting a lot of people say, oh, how dare you talk about anxiety in those terms. Anxiety has no positives. Anxiety ruins my life, etc., 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 which is a very typical thing. But the thing is, I didn't write... I didn't write anxiety as my superpower on a great day. I wrote it feeling a lot of anxiety. And so it was my sort of like comforting mechanism to sort of, and what's worked for me in the past is you take something bad and horrible in your life and you try and spin it and you try and make it into something good and positive. So I do believe that in a way, anxiety sometimes, occasionally sharpens my mind, not always in a good way, but it makes you more in tune with things and more alert to things, and it makes you ask a lot of questions, and questions can be good for writing and stuff. So I was trying to take all those potential positives and saying it's my superpower. I would, in those states of high anxiety, much rather live without it, but as a way to live without it, I was trying to sort of accept it, and I just put it flippantly. In a moment of madness, I put anxiety as my superpower out onto my Twitter account, and I got a lot of negativity back, which made me feel more anxiety. So I found it quite ironic, these people sticking up for mental health by making someone feel more anxiety. But there you go. That is the modern world of Twitter. But I have become a bit more careful of how, as a... because I'm seen as, in my own country now, a mental health spokesperson. So I have to be a little bit more careful with the language I use, not just for other people, but also for myself, because I don't want to have to, you know, deal with all the negativity that comes from that. But yeah, it didn't go down well.
How does that feel to be something of a mental health spokesperson in the UK?
It's kind of scary because it gives you a responsibility, and I'm not a doctor. I'm not someone with trained experience. I was someone with a history degree at university. I am just somebody who had an experience. I have had mental health issues. I recovered from them. I wrote about that. And in this new book, I'm exploring other things that affect my mind and other people's minds. And so for a little while, to be perfectly honest with you, I was really like scared of it, because my first book about mental health was read by a lot of people in the UK, and it meant I was getting a lot of emails from people, a lot of them in quite a bad state of mind, and they would be asking questions that I couldn't answer, or they'd be in a dangerous place, or even occasionally suicidal place. And, you know, that was a lot of responsibility to, as a novelist, which had been before, to suddenly take on. And I needed a lot of help from charities and stuff to tell me how, you know, the right phone numbers for these people to call and all of that. So for a little while, it was scary. But now, I'm quite proud of it. And it's good to feel like you've done something useful and help people and help them sort of stay alive and deal with their own issues and all of that. And it's a good thing. And my whole approach now to mental health is to have no shame about it. You know, it's a health issue. It shouldn't have any more shame than if you're talking about asthma or arthritis or whatever else. It's just a condition that people have. And that line, that brick wall we have between the mental and physical shouldn't really be there, because it all relates, it all connects. So many mental things are also physical things and vice versa. So I'm totally fine with this mental health ambassador or mental health speaker role now, because I've no longer got anything to be afraid of or ashamed of.
There are two lists I want to get to in the 2 minutes we have left. One of them is how to be happy, where you list the same thing 7 times. Don't compare yourself to other people. So that's great advice there. But then finally, there's another list about how to stay sane on the internet. I wonder if you can give us a few highlights before we go.
Yeah, well, basically the list is about remembering that people are, but it's not real life. It's not real life. That's the whole thing that runs through the book. It's if you want to connect with somebody, you connect with them in real life, and to take it with a pinch of salt. And that was my whole sort of argument. You know, it's fun and use it as fun, but the moment it stops serving you is the moment you should stop using it.
Do you feel generally pretty good these days? Is the anxiety mostly abated?
Yeah, I mean, I have to be careful. I have to keep on top of it. I have to sort of be quite disciplined and go to bed on time and, you know, get out and go for a run in the morning and do things like that. But I'm in a much happier place. And to be honest with you, I no longer regret what I went through. I've actually known more happiness in my life because of it, you know, this side of the line. Not when I'm depressed, obviously, but in between times, I'm much more thankful of life. I'm much more grateful for the people I've got and for my wife and my children and my friends and family and all of that. And so, in a way, I've learned to be thankful for even those bad experiences because it's made me appreciate life much more.
There's lots of wonderful stuff in the book. It really was a pleasure to read. The book is called Notes on a Nervous Planet. It's by Matt Haig, who also wrote Reasons to Stay Alive. And has written a bunch of novels, including How to Stop Time. Matt, thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.